Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, what do you get when you put together a former Republican and a former Democrat who are both urgently hoping to put Connecticut back on track? Today, we're opening our 2018 campaign coverage, talking with former lifelong Republican Oz Griebel and lifelong Democrat Monty Frank, who have both shed their major party affiliations to run together for governor and lieutenant governor, but as independents. Then we'll catch up with a program manager at Operation Fuel to learn how that agency and its 100 partner distribution centers are doing as residents in need of heating assistance work their way through one of the coldest early winters in memory and in the face of federal heating assistance cutbacks. Finally, we'll pop into Adams House, which is recruiting now for its next Friends in Grief or FIG training program, equipping volunteers to assist children and families who are suffering through the grief process after the tragedy of losing a loved one. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. YWCA Hartford Region will host Community Matters Disparity of Discipline for Girls of Color Wednesday, January 24th from 6 to 8 at YWCA Hartford Region's Saramundi Room. The panel discussion will address how girls of color receive a disproportionate degree of discipline and punishment to nonviolent student behavior that's subjectively interpreted as disrespectful, including being 2.7 times more likely to be referred to juvenile justice than white girls. The event will also offer actionable steps the community can follow in an effort to reduce these disparities. If you want to be involved, register online now at ywcahartford.org.
Well, as we move into 2018 here, we are coming into a big Connecticut-wide political race, and I'm pleased to be sitting here with a couple of folks who are going to be involved in it. A lifelong Republican and former gubernatorial candidate, Oz Griebel, who we know by association for many, many years, and a gentleman who I consider a good friend, lifelong Democrat, Monty Frank, and together they're running as independents for governor and lieutenant governor. We're here in Newtown right before a press conference to announce the this entire thing. Although the announcement has been out for a couple weeks and it's been public. But I have a chance to talk with these gentlemen and introduce them to our Connecticut radio audience. So, guys, thanks for sitting with me. And first and foremost, there's a couple of tables full of petitions outside. So can you briefly just explain to folks listening what the process is in terms of being independent versus being party affiliate and how the petitioning plays a role?
Sure. So I won't put people to sleep, though, John. Thank you for the opportunity.
The Reader's Digest version.
I'll give you the read. And quite simply, we do need to get 7,500 signatures of registered voters throughout anywhere in the state of Connecticut. So we're delighted here today, obviously in Monty's hometown, to really kick this off, the petition, the signature solicitation effort in earnest. And we'll be here for several hours at the town hall asking anyone coming in to sign a petition that will build towards that 7,500 that we need to be certified to be on the ballot. So it's a great, it's definitely a grassroots effort. Yeah. And the fun part of it is you get a chance to meet a lot of people. Just talking to a few people here this morning before the press conference, who were coming through, just asking them to stop, talk to them a little bit about it, get them to know, make sure they know where our website is, and really build this effort towards getting their votes in November. So it's a fun process, but it's a laborious one. You've got to make the effort to go and ask people for their signatures.
Yeah. And multi-generational political education.
Correct.
Going out there, some young people getting to know you as well.
Exactly. So you've got everybody from, spoke briefly with a woman who's been here, born and raised in Newtown, been here all her life. Her grandchildren are here. I think she was with here, a couple of her grandchildren here, granddaughters this morning. And so you get that. And then we've got Kyle, one of Kyle's daughters out here. I mean, one of Monty's daughters is working on out there. So we're going to get everybody from the retiree all the way down to somebody who's in college.
So Oz, tell me, you had previously run for governor. So does that give you at least a little bit of advantage hitting the ground, if not running, at least walking very quickly in terms of having a little bit of infrastructure behind you to be able to fan out across the state and hopefully gather all the signatures you need?
Well, to be honest with you, Jen, the best thing I've got going for me is the experience I've had at the Metro Hartford Alliance for the last 16 plus years, because that's where I've built, been involved in public, that organization has been involved in public policy issues. So as a result, I've gotten to know a lot of people around the state and try to build off of that. And Monty's experience with the Connecticut Bar Association, his leadership down here, in Newtown over the last several years, particularly in leading the focus on as a result of the Sandy Hook tragedy of the issue of reducing gun violence. I think we've got a great network, combined network, that'll get us off the ground.
Also, in terms of Monty, his national recognition for some groundbreaking initiatives that he was able to mount as the president of Connecticut Bar Association, right. But I won't talk about that. I'll let Monty do that.
Exactly.
Monty, aside from the fact that you're very well known throughout the state of Connecticut as an advocate and with the Bar Association and have made some national and even international splash, what are a few of the things that you are bringing to the table to help complement this team and hopefully propel yourselves into the governor's office?
Well, you mentioned to Oz that he may be walking or running for office.
Yes.
I like to think about riding to office. I prefer riding rather than walking or running. But, one of the things that was really attractive to me when Oz approached me with this idea is the concept of bringing together Republicans and Democrats on an independent bipartisan ticket.
Yeah.
What we are seeing as we talk to voters throughout the state is that they're exhausted by the political gridlock that is occurring not only in Hartford but in Washington. We can't change what's going on in Washington, but we can make a significant difference as to what's going to happen in our future in Hartford. Oz and I were the only candidates who were at the Connecticut Business Association's Economic Summit yesterday. One of the things we heard loud and clear from the CEOs there is that Connecticut is on the clock, and that if we don't take some significant measures soon, we're going to reach a point where our quality of life is going to be impacted. And if you look at Oz's credentials, he has the ability to really develop private-public partnerships and turn the state around.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not doing it at the expense of our most vulnerable. And I think that's where I come in. My career has as a lawyer and subsequently has been in the business world. But in the last few years with the Connecticut Bar Association, the American Bar Association, I focused a lot on social justice, access to justice, defending the rule of law, working to protect the most vulnerable in our society. So we form a great team, and we complement each other. So we can be fiscally responsible. We can grow our economy and at the same time not lose focus on protecting our most vulnerable.
Yeah. And on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, you've also been a town attorney, so to speak. So you have probably a little bit more heightened knowledge and appreciation of both the needs and the interworkings of the many municipalities that come together here in Connecticut.
Yeah, as Connecticut Bar Association president, I spent a lot of time in the legislature. I chaired the Legislative Policy Review Committee of the Bar for 2 years. At the same time, I've been a municipal attorney for 20-some-odd years, not just in Newtown, but in working with other municipalities.
Yeah.
So, I was talking to a first selectman the other night and explaining that, having someone like me teamed up with Oz in Hartford is a great team because we understand how municipalities work, how municipalities plan, how they budget, so that we can work with municipalities to make sure that they're not caught in the in the crosshairs like they were this last budget cycle.
Yeah. Oh, if you're just joining us, we're sitting with Oz Griebel and Monty Frank. They're running for governor and lieutenant governor, respectively, as independents. Oz, as many listening may know, is a lifelong Republican. Monty Frank, a lifelong Democrat, a very interesting mix with, I believe, a lot of potential to bring things together. I'll ask you both, how much do you think of what's going on in Washington, as Monty pointed out, could help you guys gain some more intense traction as things move forward and you gather the signatures to qualify for the ballot?
I'm not sure I know what the impact of Washington is. I think that, just to repeat something Monty said a minute ago, we know what it's like here in Connecticut, and we know that the high level of frustration of not getting a budget passed until October, then the budget not really being balanced to begin with, and now we've got a special session coming up next week to deal with this, with a veto coming. So I think you don't need to really go outside of Connecticut to know what the frustration is. Monty mentioned the impact on municipal aid and what that's meant to people, municipalities that already set their budgets, than having to deal with further cutbacks. So I think the frustration level is here. We wouldn't be running if we didn't fully appreciate and understand the frustration that's here and the desire for people to see a different approach. We're providing people a different view. You mentioned the fact that both of us have been lifelong members of two distinct parties. Mm-hmm. We've both re-registered as unaffiliated voters. The point that Monty said this a number of times, when you think about stereotypical views of parties, a stereotypical Republican doesn't care about social justice issues, and a stereotypical Democrat doesn't care about fiscal issues. Mm-hmm. The reality is voters care about both. Residents care about both. They care about the economy. They care about how their tax dollars are being spent, and they care about their quality, their education for their children. Mm-hmm. They care about the people who don't have the ability to take care of themselves at a given point in time. They care about issues like the opioid addiction and what the impact of that is. So that what we're trying to demonstrate is that you can't pick one issue and say, "Oh yeah, if you just elect me, we'll fix this one issue, and life is going to be good in Connecticut." It's the economy broadly defined. It's the society broadly defined. And I think bringing this more, our slogan right now is no parties, no politics, just solutions. That's how we're trying to capture the essence of what we're running about. Mm-hmm.
I first came to appreciate your skill set, Oz, when you were chairing the Transportation Task Force,
right,
particularly focusing on the I-95 corridor. And in the ensuing years and up to now, how much of the work that you did then do you think is in the process of being accomplished? And is there anything from that period of time that you felt was really, really important that hasn't gotten its due?
Well, when we were required, that Transportation Strategy Board, when it was established, we were required to come back with a plan, and we were required under the law to specify the funding sources. I think that the idea of what that board, to me, epitomizes what Monty and I are about. It was a bipartisan group. There were people appointed to it, 15 members, people appointed by then-Governor Rowland, by leadership in the House. There were several people from the private sector. We had the commissioners from DECD and DOT and whatnot. And it took a year to do the plan, but in that plan, we agreed, 15 folks from different parts of the state, different parties, on three funding sources, that we would restore the 15 cents. The recommendation was to restore the 15 cents in the gasoline tax that had been eliminated in 99, to put a surcharge in on the sales tax for 10 years, and to start electronic tolls. The issue we have in infrastructure investment is lack of money. And the fact that none of that has been done, the gasoline tax, I think 3 cents has gone back in over the last 17 years. We never put the surcharge in on the sales tax, and we've never gotten electronic tolls done. So when you look at the challenge we're facing in this state and how important transportation is to make sure that Connecticut remains linked to Boston and New York, which are two huge assets for us, that's, I think, Governor Malloy has been very clear that this has been pushing on that as hard as he can. On the ballot in 18, there will be a constitutional amendment to secure transportation funding, so we as taxpayers know that if we do any of the things I just mentioned, that money would be secure. But that's a huge issue for us right now, John, and it's going to undermine our ability, unless we get the funding to keep the Metro North running, to do the work that needs to be done on I-95, to replace the viaduct in Hartford. Those are critical things, and to make sure that the towns have the money they need for their local bridges and roads.
Okay. If we're serious about growing jobs and growing the economy, then we need to focus on transportation and our infrastructure, and particularly down in this part of the state. You know, there needs to be this 30-30-30 concept put into place where 30 minutes from New Haven to Bridgeport, 30 minutes from Bridgeport to Stanford. We need to open up the ways, the mechanism, whether it's by train or by the highways, in order to allow people to get to their jobs. I mean, we all know living here in Newtown that it on some days it could take upwards of 2 hours to get to Stanford. It's not that far. There's no reason for that. Mm-hmm. So we need to have that infrastructure in place on the transportation side. Mm-hmm. But that's only one piece of the infrastructure puzzle that Oz and I are going to solve. The other piece is having the infrastructure for technology. You know, when you look at the reasons why GE left, and there's a lot of speculation about that. But one of the things that we heard loud and clear was that they left because they were trying to become a high-tech company, and there was a high-tech corridor up in Boston. Those conversations should have been occurring 8-10 years ago. You know, it's the role of the governor to make sure that there is a conversation between the private sector and government so that we understand what they are forecasting out, what their needs are, and we can accommodate them so that the jobs stay here and they can grow their business and we can help them do that. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be a partnership. Includes the universities, includes growing the universities, making sure there's a technology that surrounds universities, and creating not only jobs around the high tech, but incentives for our kids to go to college here in Connecticut and to stay in Connecticut when they come out, because we've built the hubs in the cities and we've built the technology around them.
Yeah. And Monty, you bring an important point, and I have to imagine both of you in your social travels, in your own personal family circles, you're sitting with friends and relatives and neighbors who are wringing their hands over the fact that their kids are going away or have gone away to college, and it appears they're not coming back anytime soon. We had guests on our program a month or so ago from Sacred Heart University who just produced a groundbreaking study on the flight of residents from the state of Connecticut. And we just saw the other day in the Hartford newspaper great concerns about the departure of income tax dollars, mm-hmm. particularly to Florida. I'll start with Monty. Monty, what are your feelings in terms of the most important thing that you'd need to do hitting the ground running as an administration to begin the steps of not just retaining Connecticut residents, young residents as college students, but bringing them back once they leave Connecticut and start experiencing perhaps more vibrant economies and more exciting urban and suburban centers?
Yeah, we really need to make the cities our hubs. I mean, that's been something that's been lacking for a number of years. I work in Bridgeport. You know, after 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock in Bridgeport downtown, there's nobody down there. You know, we need to make that, unless there's a game, but, you know, we really need to make the cities our hubs. They need to be vibrant. They need to be built and structured in a way that will attract young people when they either in college or when they come out of college. And so, you know, it goes back to what I was just talking about in creating these partnerships, creating the infrastructure around the cities, the high tech, bringing business in, bringing jobs in, so that we can have a chance of keeping the kids. The other part of the problem on the other side is, and Oz and I heard this loud and clear from the business community yesterday, is, you know, if someone 65 or 70 decides that they want to move down to Florida, there's really not much we can do to stop that. And that's just
no matter how much income tax they pay.
Exactly, or no income tax. Yeah. But the problem is what we are seeing is a migration of people who are in their late 50s, and they are leaving Connecticut and taking a lot of wealth with them. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant problem that we need to address. It's going to take some talking to people, listening to what their needs are, and making some changes in the way we run our state. Yeah. And Oz is, you know, Oz has obviously been thinking a lot about that and I think has the solutions.
Yeah. And Oz, as Monty said, urban centers are critically important,
right.
But virtually every community in Connecticut is either has a standalone or is part of a consortium of economic development offices or has their own office. Right. Let's talk about the urban, suburban, rural kind of disparities that we have here in Connecticut in terms of economic development and how that plays a role in hopefully keeping young people here, or the 50-somethings, 40-somethings, or bringing the young people back once they go away and become equipped to really serve Connecticut as great citizens when they get back or get done with college.
I'm going to do a little bit of a curveball on you here, John, just to say, but to augment something that Monty said earlier. Yeah. The other thing we have to keep in mind, this, you're looking at electric boat looking to hire 15,000 people.
Right, right, right.
You've got Pratt Whitney looking to hire probably the year after this another 10,000 people.
Yeah.
In fact, somebody said yesterday at the Economic Summit, there's probably 25,000 jobs that are going begging right now.
Yeah, yes.
And if you think about this from the standpoint of where the state is, the phrase we've been using is we need to reignite private sector confidence in this state, so that the jobs, that the best thing that will start changing the dynamics, all these things we're talking about, flight and everything else. Mm-hmm. If there were 25,000 more people working in the state, if there were 150,000 more people working in the state, the dynamic changes incredibly. So it's not just the fact that we've got the sub-base that has those defense contracts, or that Pratt has the F-35 contracts. We need to make sure that there are other things going on in here, and getting people to see, yes, I'm going to keep the jobs I have here today, whether it's a small manufacturer or it's one of the major employers, we're keeping those jobs, we're going to be adding the next one here.
No matter where they are. These aren't service sector incomes.
Correct. These are jobs that are going to pay upwards of $100,000, and you put the benefits in there. Those are jobs in which people can raise a family, a middle class, this so-called middle-class opportunity. And that's what we're talking about, is not growth for a limited segment of the population, but growth that's going to provide opportunities for everybody in the state of Connecticut. Just to give you a quick reaction to on the question you asked, is I think we do need this whole notion of bringing people under a tent and talking about the issue, get some agreement on what these issues are. Can we really in this day and age afford 169 of everything? Does every municipality have to deliver the service the same time over and over again? Do we need all the administrative overhead that's there? Now, I recognize, having come to this state 25 years ago, how much pride a new town takes in the fact that it's Newtown. Or I grew up, raised my family in Simsbury. That was a big deal. People in the cities feel the same way. But I think trying to sit down and say what's best for the state of Connecticut, I think we need to have those kinds of discussions, not to go to county government. I want to really be clear on this.
Right.
But the fact that there are councils of governments, there's some opportunities here. We know that municipal aid's not going to get bigger in the next couple of years. So how do we take the monies we have and use them more intelligently for the benefit of the municipalities across the board and reduce the cost of doing business in the state? Because property tax is probably the single largest tax that any business pays, whether it's on their real estate or if you're a manufacturer, you're paying that on your equipment.
Great. I'm sure we'll be talking again to both of you. I thank you for this opportunity and the opportunity to showcase what you're doing to our listeners across the state of Connecticut. In a minute or so, just last word from you, Monty Frank, running for lieutenant governor on the independent ticket, hopefully, with signatures.
We'll get the signatures, John, and Oz and I can work hard. We think we'll get a lot more incentivized signatures. To close, as we head towards Martin Luther King Day, I want to touch on what Oz mentioned earlier about the big tent. I've worked as the son of a Holocaust survivor, and my grandparents are survivors, and we lost countless family members in the Holocaust when we saw politics of hate go to an extreme. Oz and I are going to build a big tent. Diversity and inclusion is going to be one of the hallmarks of both our campaign and our administration. And so we want to bring in as many people as we can, the most talented people with the best ideas, and work really hard. Not just the diversity part of our campaign administration, but really on the inclusion. And I think you'll see a little more of that as we head towards Martin Luther King Day and as the campaign goes forward.
Very good. Oz?
GriebelFrank4CT.com. We've got all the information there, and I'll just send your ideas in, because this whole notion of a Big Ten is to say, what is your idea? What do you see as the biggest problem in the state? What would you like as a Griebel Frank administration to address? So GriebelFrank4CT.com, and thank you for the opportunity.
All the answers are there. If not now,
they
soon will be. Great. Oz Griebel, Monty Frank, running for governor and lieutenant governor as independents. Thank you so much for the time.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Military veterans of all ages will receive a warm welcome to the monthly Veterans Coffee House hosted by Assisted Living Services at the Wallingford Senior Center coming up on Tuesday, January 23rd at 10 a.m. Speaker Ken Duncan from Wallingford will share his experience as a Merchant Marine officer and U.S. Navy officer during World War II. The group meets on the fourth Tuesday of every month in Wallingford and also on the third Tuesday of the month in Cheshire. If you'd like to know more, you can call 203-634-8668 or just click on assistedlivingct.com. Well, we're visiting again with a brand new friend at Operation Fuel. If you're not aware of the organization, Operation Fuel partners with local governments and community-based organizations at more than 100 different sites throughout the state of Connecticut to ensure that families in need have access to year-round energy assistance. One of the disturbing things that we've learned from the organization is that Connecticut energy costs, and it's a constant reminder, actually, Connecticut energy costs are about the highest in the nation, and Operation Fuel is great about producing data and information. Right now, Connecticut's annual home energy affordability gap is $450 million for households with income at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. And that, according to this year's home energy affordability gap report for Connecticut. Our guest this morning is the Director of Community Programs, Brenda Watson, who is a first-time representative on our program. Brenda, great to meet you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
So quickly, just tell us a little bit about what you do at Operation Fuel. What are your hands-on responsibilities?
Oh, so I'm responsible for managing our residential energy assistance program, providing technical support services to our over our 100 fuel banks who serve as our intake sites, and overseeing the budget for the program. We are hoping to provide $1.9 million in home heating and grants for electric and gas utilities this winter season.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like with water. You don't realize it's gone or how bad you need it until you turn on the tap and it's not there. And I have to believe that for so many people, especially during the recent extended Arctic cold snap, you know, they go to their thermostat, they're feeling a little breeze through the house, feeling a little chilly, they just crank that thermostat up, the heat goes on and makes them comfortable again. But there are an incredible, incredible number of people in Connecticut who cannot afford their energy bills. Let's talk about those numbers.
Yeah, so each year we run a energy affordability gap study. 11 years ago, our former executive director, Pat Rice, had the vision to illustrate how this issue impacts more people than what is assumed through a report rather than just speaking about the number of households we serve and how many grants we provided. Mm-hmm. So we're in the 11th year of providing this gap study, and this year the study notes that there are over 320,000 households in Connecticut that cannot afford their energy bills. On average, each household owes about $1,400 more in their annual energy costs, more than they can afford to pay.
Mm. Is this as bad as it's ever been, or has it been significantly better or worse over the 11 years of reporting, if you even know?
Oh, it's significantly worse than ever before, because each year the cost of living in Connecticut continues to go up. And what that means is the cost of food goes up, the cost of basic needs goes up, the cost of gas. It's just, unfortunate way of life in the Northeast that it's expensive to live here. So we're finding that households who may have not needed our support services before are now calling and seeking assistance from us. So we raised our income guidelines from 60% of the state median income to 75% of the state median income. So what that means is a household of four, as long as their income does not exceed $82,000 a year, that's before taxes, they can apply for assistance. And that sounds like a lot of money, but once taxes are paid, once you pay your rent or your mortgage, once you have bought food, once you've purchased other basic needs, there you are with your home energy bills, whether it be deliverable fuel or electric or gas utility.
So what's the threshold beyond which you technically qualify someone's energy bills as being unaffordable?
So what our study has determined is that so for households in Connecticut, mm-hmm. Folks who are at 200% or below the federal poverty guideline, they're paying about $1,400 more a year. Our study notes is that households should not pay more than 6% of their household
6%,
annual yeah. income on home energy. But we're finding that people are, depending on where they are in the income scale, are paying anywhere between 24% and sometimes 50% of their income on home energy. So the lower they are on the income scale, the higher the burden.
There was great worry over reductions from the federal government to the states, including Connecticut, that you know was pretty scary out on the horizon.
Right.
How is that shaking out?
Well, so far on the federal side, the state receives funding called LIHEAP. It's the low income home energy assistance program.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut received a $78 million grant from that program for this fiscal year. We're not sure what the feds are going to do for next year. I know that there's threat of the budget being, you know, zeroed out for this program. So we're not, at this point, we can only kind of focus on what we are working with right now. And we're hoping that more people would actually apply for that program because, and speaking with colleagues in the field, I've been hearing that the number of people applying for that program has actually dropped. So I'm hoping that folks who are listening right now will call 211 and request an appointment with their nearest fuel bank or community action agency to apply for energy assistance. And Operation Fuel is that program that helps folks who either do not qualify for that program or have qualified and have exhausted their benefit and still need help throughout the winter to get additional assistance. I mean, we also provide assistance with electric and gas utilities. So there are multiple programs that people in need can apply for, and we're hoping to, you know, our agencies work together, Operation Fuel, along with the community action agencies and our municipal fuel banks. We work together to ease the energy burden on folks who are struggling.
Is Operation Fuel the sole funder for these programs at the municipal level, or do various municipalities have other different revenue streams to fortify the funds that they then turn around and distribute to people who qualify for energy assistance?
The answer to that is yes and no. So some municipal fuel banks do have their own private funds, which they raise on their own, and they provide assistance with any type of basic need that people are struggling with. It could be, you mentioned water at the top of this interview. Sometimes water assistance help with home or rent mortgage payments and assistance with home heating or even food. So that's the case for our municipal fuel banks who have that money set aside. And then there are fuel banks who are on the municipal side who do not, because they're just, you know, the resources are just not available to them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So then in that case, yes, Operation Fuel is one of the programs that they administer to help, you know,
yeah,
help folks with relief with this with this need, and if they are also working with the Community Action Agency in that area, then they can also apply for that program.
Okay, great. Is there proof as to why there's that kind of drop in applications to the LIHEAP program?
There's no evidence to support why there's a drop. We are speculating that because the price of oil has, even though it's still unaffordable, it's dropped from what it was 3-4 years ago. I don't know if you recall, and when it was almost $4 and $5 a gallon.
Yeah.
Now it's closer to more like $2.70 a gallon. So the benefit that folks are receiving from the state's energy assistance program is likely taking folks through the winter. The state has done a great job in providing folks with information and access to weatherization programs that help provide some internal work within the home make the home more energy efficient.
Huh.
So that could also be helping out. Again, all speculation. We don't know sure.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't know what's driving the numbers to drop. So
Well, the bottom line is that if people think that they would like to get some energy assistance, they should contact their local community action agency or local social services office to apply for the LIHEAP, you said, right?
Right. For that, along with Operation Fuel, depending on, you know, which program they qualify for, because they could qualify for Operation Fuel but not qualify for energy assistance. So, we want folks to not wait until the last minute or even suffer in silence. We do know of, for a fact, of some people, mostly seniors, who will sit in a cold house for months before they even ask for help, or before someone discovers, you know, maybe a child from out of state comes home to visit, you know, mom or dad, and they've discovered that there's been no heat in the house for a few weeks.
Brenda, the way, I guess, that every single person who's listening in the state of Connecticut can help is through the Add a Dollar program on their utility bill, which does provide energy assistance for more than 40,000 Connecticut households over the history of the program. And all they need to do is look at their utility bills, and it's clearly marked on there where they can just add a dollar. And if every single person who receives a utility bill that can afford it added a dollar in Connecticut, it would probably go quite far toward eliminating this gap and towards fortifying these poor people who choose to suffer in silence and in the cold. More than, or almost half, I guess, of your almost 8,000 people that were helped last year were children under 18 and or elderly, right?
That's correct. Yes. Yes, the majority of our applicants are seniors, and the majority of our applicants who come from a family situation have children in a household, and very often those children are under the age of 5. Sometimes it's a newborn baby, and so we believe in the impact that we're making by ensuring that children and seniors have a warm place to stay, as well as having electricity in the home. Because, you know, what's the point of having food if you can't keep it refrigerated or even cook it?
Right. Well, we appreciate you chatting with us this morning. Brenda Watson is the Director of Community Programs for Operation Fuel. Their website is operationfuel.org if you'd like to learn more. But all you really have to do is add a dollar through the program offered on your utility bill to make a huge difference. Operation Fuel partners with local government and community-based organizations at more than 100 sites throughout Connecticut to ensure families in need, as you've heard from Brenda, have access to year-round energy assistance. It all starts with a call to 211 info line. If you'd like more information, or once again, visit the website, operationfuel.org. Brenda, thank you so much. Great to meet you and great work there. We'll be talking to Operation Fuel again soon. Thanks.
Well, we are back in Shelton this morning and pleased once again to be the guest of Allison Wisota and Adam's House here. Adam's House is a safe, healing place for families as they go through an eight-week grief journey. And we're going to actually meet a family alumni of the program. Mike Baccio is here with us. He and his son have gone through the program. But the reason we're here is an exciting new training program is in the midst of forming now. It's called their FIG program, and we're going to talk a little bit about that with Brittany Miller-Cadmus, who's the head of fundraising and volunteers. But first, let's go to Allison Wisota, who is the founder and executive director of Adam's House here, just to remind us now in our third visit here to you since literally before you even opened the doors. And I love this relationship, Allison, because you were really savvy about reaching out and partnering with a number of key organizations and entities like our radio stations, even before you opened the door. In fact, while this was almost in its formation stages, mm-hmm. but now you're approaching year two.
Yes.
Anniversary.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit and remind us exactly what you do here at Adam's House.
Yeah, no, thanks, John. You've been a great supporter, so it's wonderful to have you back. Yeah, so Adam's House, as you mentioned, is a grief education center for bereaved children in Connecticut. So if you've had any kind of loss that has affected your children, then Adam's House is an appropriate service for you. Many times people think there's a time limit on that, but, you know, grief has a way of kind of popping up maybe a year down the road, maybe 2 years down the road. So if your child is experiencing some difficulties, then, you know, you give us a call and we start the process. And like you mentioned, it is an eight-week program. It's a closed group, so you start with the same people that you finish with. And it is really peer support. So we are not a counseling session. We're not a counseling center. Mm-hmm. But the kids really need to be validated and heard by their peer group. And we find that as to be in a very effective way to cope with their grief.
And I know initially the programming here was ideally intended to be delivered with folks sort of in residence at the location. Has that been maintained, or are folks typically just coming here and sort of dropping in?
No, yeah, no one lives here. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's
no
not,
one lives
here. Not a residential
no,
situation.
Not residential, oh, okay. No. They come once a week for 8 weeks. They start their session, their evening with a meal together, and that's really unfacilitated. That's mm-hmm. just an opportunity for the families to get to know each other before mm-hmm. our session starts. And then we break out into our groups, and upstairs are all we kind of break out into age-appropriate groups. So mm-hmm. we have littles, middles, and teens, and then the parent group is downstairs. So the parents, not a drop-off, the parents stay on site, which sometimes, you know, the children want to kind of peek downstairs yeah. and make sure their parents still there.
Sure.
So that's kind of how program night works.
Yeah. Okay, so that's probably what I was remembering, is mm-hmm. that you keep the parents on site
yes.
when you're counseling with
yes.
the children. And just a little backstory on this, the inception of this whole project.
So the backstory is almost 6 years ago, my husband passed. I still have three children. I have three sons who were going through the grief process, all, you know, bravely, and they were amazing and resilient, but all very different. And in search of services for them and support for them, the one piece I couldn't give them was the peer support. And they really didn't, their friends were wonderful and our community was terrific, but they didn't have other kids their age who were going through what they were going through. And that was the piece that was missing. So as a family, we decided, you know, these families need support. And one of our missions is that any family who's seeking support should get support. So our services are at no cost, which makes Brittany's job that much harder because fundraising is super important. Mm. And really, from an insurance perspective, we try to work with providers. We have a list of 15 providers that we refer to. And we really kind of work with the family and the provider and Adam's house to make sure that family is supported in mm-hmm. any way, shape, or form through their grief process. Mm-hmm. But that is really kind of how it started.
How many folks through the program from folks like our family, alumni Mike Baccio, who we're going to speak with in a moment?
So we had seven families in Mike's group, and we have nine families going out in February mm-hmm. for the next group.
And how many served by Adams House in the short almost 2 years that you've been? Are we talking many dozens or hundreds?
No. So we just getting started. So our first group, I think all in, we were 20, 22 okay. with kids. Mm-hmm. Our next group, we're at 30. So by the year end, you know, I kind of hope we're hitting that, 7,500 mark. So yes.
Great. Very good. Allison Masoda, founder and executive director of Adams House here in Shelton. If you'd like to learn more about them, you could check them out online at adamshousect.org or give them a call at 203-513-2808. You can learn all about their programming and fundraising and other activities to get to know them better. And you are not jurisdictional to Shelton or the Valley?
No, we always like to stay here. We are conveniently located right off Route 8. Mm. So we really dissect the state. If you're willing to commit to the 8 weeks and you're willing to commit to the drive, then we will happily accept you. We have families in our next group that are coming as far as Litchfield County. Uh-huh. So people come as far as an hour away. And again, if you're ready to make the commitment to our program, we don't turn you away.
Mike Baccio was one of those families who was not turned away and sounds like took great advantage of the program here. Mike, tell us a little bit about your situation.
Well, I lost my wife in March of this past year. I have a 11-year-old son, and my main concern was making sure he got the support and met people that had been in a similar situation. So through referrals, I was able to meet Allison, and I was encouraged to come in.
Mm. Only child?
Yeah.
I imagine with no sibling peers, that was devastating.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your experience coming through the door. How did you learn about Adams House?
I had contacted the Shelton School psychologist and psychiatrist to see if they had referrals. And I had talked to a therapist, and they recommended, there was two sites, but they recommended Adam House and another site. I came to the facility. The facility is beautiful. It's been redone, and it's very, very inviting. And my son needed to sit and get through his anger. He was very, very angry.
Without digging in too deep or getting too personal, if you could just kind of relate to folks listening a couple of the high points of your experience that have turned you from an alumni into an advocate for Adams House.
Well, the main thing is that you see that there are other people in a similar situation, and that it's okay to express how you feel, especially with my son, who was so very, very angry that, this is going to pass someday. And
people that throw things and they say, there's more over there to throw if you need to, right?
Yeah. And the people, the group that I was with, fortunate enough to be with, very, very helpful, very, very candid. And most importantly, were very, very welcoming of my son, which was most important.
Peer-to-peer friendships emerge for him out of the experience?
Yeah. He, as a matter of fact, he out of the 8 weeks, he was in a bad frame of mind for the first five. Yeah. And then he started to loosen up a little bit, and he made friends with a little young lady and then two other older boys. And he actually started to want to come to the sessions.
That's great. Anything else you'd like to say to folks who think that they couldn't possibly just immerse themselves into a group of strangers at what might be the darkest days of their family lives?
It was, being an Italian, we're not too communicative when it comes to feelings. However, this effort really helped myself and my son understand that it's okay to let people know how you feel, especially if you're with a trusting group and they're responsible and really wonderful adults that help you through it. So I can't, obviously it's a terrible, terrible situation, but very, very helpful.
And part of the reason why there are so many being so helpful to folks like the Vaccio family is because they had the right training. And some of that training is imminently coming up at the end of the month. The deadline to register for what they're calling FIG training is January 20th. Once again, if you'd like to learn more about what we'll be hearing about in the next couple of minutes with Brittany Miller-Cadmus, who's the head of fundraising and volunteer here at Adams House, is to go to their website, adamshousect.org, or give them a call at 203-513-2808. And it has slipped my mind, but Brittany will remind me, FIG is Families in Grief?
It's Friends in Grief.
Friends in Grief.
We lovingly call them our Friends in Grief. So it's what makes our entire place, our 8 weeks, what really works is that they are all volunteers.
And the backbone of the system that you provide here in this kind of somewhat unique environment.
Absolutely. We could not run our programs. We could not help people like Mike without our volunteers going through our training that's happening at the end of this month.
So let us know what the details of the FIG training are for folks who might want to join. You still have room for the upcoming program?
Yes, we definitely have some room that coming up for the upcoming program. It's going to be on January 25th, 26th, and 27th. So it's a Thursday, Friday night, and a Saturday morning. It's only 12 hours. But what you're going to get out of that is being able to really help the children. So we do as much as we can to prepare you that this is not about solving the children's problems or getting too deep in. It's about being there for them. So when they are stuck in a conversation, you know, how do you volley into another piece of that? Or, you know, when a kid is struggling, how do you get them to open up, but open up on their own? And really just being that support system for them, that we're here for them, that we're not trying to fix them, we're not trying to rush them, we're not telling them that anything they're feeling is wrong. We're here to support them in their journey.
It also sounds like folks who complete FIG training are not only incredible assets to folks like the Vaccio family and all the others going through Adams House, but they become much more receptive and relevant friends, family members, neighbors, and coworkers because they carry this training and can probably use it if they're faced with a grieving individual anywhere else in their lives.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I went through the training at the end of the year, and now with just going through it and seeing this, you know, when someone has a loss, I am really careful about the language I'm using, that I'm not trying to tell them, oh, it's going to be okay, you're going to be okay, because one of the worst things you can say is, oh, yeah, it's okay, just keep going, keep moving, keep doing that, and, you know, it's more of the
listening. What's wrong with me if I'm not?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, you want to make sure, like, okay, what am I saying to the person who's grieving? Is it for me? Is it going to make me feel better? Or is it going to make them feel better? So the training is not only great for Adams House, but it is great to change, you know, our language with grief in general in this society.
Great. And once again, important to note that the registration for the upcoming classes that begin January 25th or thereabouts, if there's snow, is a January 20th deadline to register because a mandatory background check is required to participate. And of course, in part to evidence your commitment and in part to help underwrite so as not to cost Adams House extra expense. There's $100. Requirement for materials.
Yes, so it's $100 for the materials, but that covers the background checks, the materials. It's not a fundraising opportunity there because we're looking for volunteers. So you're volunteering your time. We do feed them, and it's very, very good. So, and we have a lot of fun during the training. If you're thinking about it, you have any questions, please, you know, pick up the phone. We'll answer anything that you could possibly think of. We've heard of everything, so we would love to encourage people to come out and take a tour of Adams House and find out what we're all about.
Great. And if folks cannot make the short-term commitment to the end of January, is there another Friends in Grief FIG training program planned for later in the year?
We always have them throughout the rest of the year, but if you're kind of just in the curious stage of volunteering, our next volunteer meeting is on Tuesday night, February 13th. It's at 6 o'clock. It's really important you kind of meet all of our volunteers, whether they're FIGs, whether they're our kind of our helpers through our events. There's many different ways that we do volunteering here, whether it's something small, you want to donate a day, or you want to donate, you know, once a month. However that helps, you know, we're ready for it. So.
Excellent. Yes, Allison.
So I just wanted to add, as far as the FIG training, many people think they have to be like a trained professional, they have to be a therapist, and you don't. And so we cover this all the time, that if you're kind, empathetic, a good listener, you go through the training, you'll do great with the groups of kids. You do not have to have that medical background.
The only requirement is they got to wanna.
Yes, exactly. And our families have to go to a therapist for 4 visits prior to starting, so that kind of covers that piece. If there's anything that needs to be handled prior to coming to a peer support group, that gets covered then.
Very good. Wrapping it up with founder and executive director Allison Wasoda here at Adams House. We want to thank you, Mike Baccio, for your input. A family alumni here of the program, Brittany Miller, CABMA's head of fundraising and volunteers, organizing this Friends in Grief training that whose registration deadline is January 20th. Get to know Adams House, if not as a FIG professional, then it may be in some other capacity by coming to their February 13th volunteers meeting. Their website is adamshousect.org, 203-513-2808. They're located right up from the Merritt Parkway off of Route 8 in Shelton. Very easy to get to from anywhere you might be listening here in Connecticut. We want to thank you once again, Adams House CT. Their FIG training comes up here at Adams House. Children and their families gather to draw support from their peers and gain new strategies for dealing with loss. Approaching the second anniversary here, we hope folks will turn out. AdamsHouseCT.org. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.